Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was the legacy of the Holocaust for U.S. Jews in the years immediately following the Second World War? Like most Americans, Jews eagerly embraced a return to normal life in the years of post-war peace that quickly chilled to Cold War tension. They built families, homes, and careers. But while some of their U.S.-born children would later accuse post-war Jews of avoiding the subject of the Holocaust, my guest this hour says that is simply not true. Her research documents dozens of nascent but meaningful attempts both to memorialize those who died in the Holocaust and to aid those who managed to survive. Hasia R. Diner is Paul S. and Sylvia Steinberg Professor of American Jewish History and Director of the Goldstein-Gorin Center for American Jewish History at New York University. Her new book is called We Remember with Reverence and Love, American Jews and the Myth of Silence After the Holocaust, 1945 to 1962. Hasia, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Let's start with this. Why do we believe that Americans, and American Jews in particular, sort of detached from the Holocaust in the years that immediately followed it?
This is a paradigm and a narrative about the post-war period that started being heard in the late 1960s amid the kind of tumult of campus activism and the kind of youth rebellion of that period of time. And young Jews very deeply involved in the criticism of American culture and in the political debates of that era, not only were criticizing American society as a whole for its shallowness and its lack of passion and its withdrawal from any kind of confrontational politics, but they were also directing their attention and one might say their venom at the adults who ran the Jewish communal institutions, schools, synagogues, seminaries, charitable philanthropic groups, summer camps, the whole range of what we would call American Jewish kind of institutional life. So these young people directed their anger at these organizations and institutions as well, and claimed that the culture that had developed in post-war America, the Jewish culture which had developed in post-war American Jewish culture, was shallow, assimilationist, lacking in Jewish passion. And one of the arguments they hurled, or one of the insults they hurled at the communal elders, was that those people had withheld the story of the Holocaust from them, that is, the young people who had grown up in that world. And so I think the origins of this, what I call the myth of silence, begins in that youth-inspired cultural criticism of the late 60s. Many of those young people went on to become academics, rabbis, communal leaders themselves as they grew up, and they brought that narrative with them, one which demonizes the post-war period, and particularly the 1950s, as this kind of nadir of ethnic assertiveness, and which they, as the new generation born of the cultural ferment of the late 60s, were going to seek to redress. So that's the origin of this myth, and it continued to take on resonance into the 1970s and 80s and 90s, and I guess into our own day. I think as different groups of scholars have accepted this truth and have written many, many books which take this as a fact which actually needs, they believe, needs no documentation. So when it's said in, when it is written in historical works, there is often no footnote to go with it, and it's just accepted as truth. And it reflects a series of political issues roiling academia and its assessment of American Jewry. And this idea has also become very deeply and widely, and I would say almost universally accepted popularly among American Jews.
Well, you know, at the risk of grossly oversimplifying this, it almost sounds as if this generation that sort of came of age in the late 60s came to that age where they were finally old enough themselves to fully understand what had happened and felt as if they were the first people to understand this. And I think every generation can be accused of something like that to a certain extent. I'm wondering, though, why they held on to this as opposed to sort of maturing out of it and recognizing in a more subtle way how their parents had commemorated and understood the Holocaust before they did.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I'd say in general the history of this time period of the post-war period is only recently being viewed with much greater sensitivity and attention to nuance and complexity than it has been. And so in many areas of sort of writing about the post-war period, there tends to be a kind of very flat analysis. One book after another, one historian after another has said, you know, the women who had worked during World War II were thrown out of the labor force when the GIs came back and kind of spent the 1950s in this kind of domestic prison camp. You know, Betty Friedan had called it the gilded concentration camps. And yet, you know, the data is very clear. More women were in the workforce in the 1950s than ever had been during World War II. So that the whole history of that period has been flattened out because it served the interests of, again, this later generation that saw itself in its coming of age as so very different and as set to undo everything that had been the legacy of the post-war period. Now, your question as to why they didn't kind of grow up and say, wait a minute, we were wrong, I think is a pretty deep one. And I think that, you know, once committed to a particular narrative, it kind of worked for them. I think in addition on the issue of the Holocaust or of Holocaust commemoration and engagement among post-war Jews, it has come to serve some very decided political purposes. So for a number of scholars who we might put more on the right side of the political spectrum, and particularly those who come from within the Jewish world, who teach at Jewish institutions, who write Jewish history, part of their narrative has basically said that it was not until the 1967 war in the Middle East that American Jews had enough self-confidence and a sense of something to be proud of, that they were able to actually deal with the Holocaust. And so this, in a way, puts Israel on a kind of cultural pedestal and says it was Israel that made American Jews willing and able to actually confront the Holocaust. For a number of scholars who would put themselves in a very different place on the political spectrum, on the left, they would, in a way, take the same position, but though from a very different perspective. And they have said to us that until 1967 and the war in the Middle East, American Jews were relatively uninterested in Israel. It was sort of just there, and they did not invest a great deal of emotion into it or try to use their political clout for it, which is also, I believe, not the case. But anyhow, be that as it may, that because the post-war generation was not so terribly interested in Israel, they had no need for the Holocaust. But after 1967, they become obsessed with Israel, and that becomes the major focus of their political agenda. And therefore, they turn to the Holocaust because they viewed it as a very potent weapon or a vehicle by which to advocate for Israel within American society. So for both of them, there is a very intimate connection between their assessment of the impact of the 1967 war, their view of American Jewish politics since 1967, and how they viewed the post-war generation's engagement with Israel.
Well, one of the things that you found, which is really interesting, is that even before people were engaged and interested in Israel, immediately following the war, there was a huge surge in the interest of American Jews in giving their children religious education as compared with the time before the war.
Yes, the post-war period is the high point of American Jewish education in terms of the number and percentage of families that sent their children to some kind of Jewish school. Now, these were usually supplementary schools, one or two afternoons a week, Sundays. Some were just on Sundays, but whatever the amount of, and there was a small population that did go to all-day parochial schools, or what were called day schools, but whatever the number of hours or the sponsoring institution or agency for these schools, it was the high water mark. At the time, many people complained that there wasn't much learning going on and that what was being taught was kind of superficial. But that, again, I think is less important than the fact that in the immediate aftermath of the war, Jewish education figures rose. One could say that part of this came from suburbanization and the fact that Jews were no longer living in very dense Jewish neighborhoods, as they had in the old central cities, where they tended to live in neighborhoods that were predominantly Jewish, and where there was a kind of Jewish atmosphere to just street life. And then when they went out to the suburbs, the parents felt the need to compensate. And I think that was certainly part of the story, a part of the explanation. But I think, again, the Holocaust added a kind of moral urgency to calls for Jewish education, and on the part of the kind of ordinary Jews in their communities, I think it so heightened their consciousness of who they were, and to try to derive some kind of meaning about this.
How did the Holocaust affect anti-Semitism in this country?
The general interpretation, and again, I think it has some very interesting ramifications for this myth of silence. Public opinion polls had been conducted since the mid-1930s. I think 1935 was the first Gallup poll. And until 1947, every opinion poll that was done found that a majority of Americans, didn't want to live next door to a Jew. They considered Jews to be less trustworthy and bought into what we might define as a pretty standard anti-Semitic set of images. In 1947, the first opinion polls begin to register a precipitous drop in anti-Semitism. And I think it was not at all accidental, and I think the Holocaust really shook up Americans into understanding, where anti-Semitism and racism in general could lead, and the implications of anti-Semitic ideas pervading the society. So there was a very dramatic drop in 1947, but for American Jews, however they celebrated that drop in anti-Semitism and the sort of beginnings of the erosion of barriers in social practice vis-a-vis anti-Semitism, the Holocaust became their yardstick by which they understood whatever anti-Semitism persisted. And so despite the drop in public opinion numbers, percentages of Americans who registered anti-Semitic attitudes in public opinion polls, the late 1940s through the early 1960s saw the constant mushrooming of anti-Semitic groups on the political right. And these were often groups that also opposed desegregation. They were groups that were vehemently anti-communist, and they tended to spew forth, and I'm going to not just dignify them by articulate, but call spew forth a message that all Jews were communists, and that they were the ones behind integration. And then usually the next sentence in their flyers, in their newspapers, in their magazines, in their speeches was, Hitler didn't kill enough of them.
Hasia Diner is my guest. Her new book is called We Remember with Reverence and Love, American Jews and the Myth of Silence After the Holocaust, 1945 to 1962. We'll resume our conversation in just a moment and welcome you to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Hasia R. Diner. She is Paul S. and Sylvia Steinberg Professor of American Jewish History at NYU and Director of the Goldstein-Gorin Center for American Jewish History. Her new book is called We Remember with Reverence and Love, American Jews and the Myth of Silence After the Holocaust, 1945 to 1962. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Hasia, I know that this is something that you had a feeling about before you undertook a formalized study of the period and the response to the Holocaust. And you had to be a little bit creative in finding memorials and commemorations, because although there were these outpourings, people didn't necessarily label them the way we would now.
Yes. I mean, I began this with, I'd say, a hunch that it just couldn't have been the way historians had been writing about this. And it was something I was conscious about since the early 1980s when I confronted this for the first time in an article by most of these people are my colleagues within the relatively small world of American Jewish historical scholarship. But it just struck me as wrong, and I kept sort of filing away these references, and I was really not inspired, though, to write this until I read, there was sort of accumulation of these works, and in a sense, that hunch came from my own recollections of the period and very public ways in which American Jews memorialized the Holocaust. And the three things that I had remembered best, I'd say perhaps give us a kind of window into what you call that creativity. So for one thing, my hometown, which happened to be Milwaukee, there was every year a Warsaw Ghetto Memorial Program. It happened every year to commemorate the uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto and to memorialize the 6 million. And in my childhood, I was always the child orator who did the Hebrew or Yiddish reading at these events. And the events always had on the dais, along with a survivor who told her story, and a choir of children who sang a song, and a speaker, the mayor of the city, and the two congressmen. And so I remember this so distinctly, and this kind of flew in the face of the emerging consensus in the scholarship. Secondly, one of the things I looked for in my research were pageants like that in other kinds of communal gatherings and how they functioned, who spoke at them, and how very early on they developed a particular format and how they were never performed merely within the sort of sequestered or hidden world of hermetically sealed world of the Jewish community. Secondly, I, like many Jewish youngsters in the 1950s and early 60s, attended summer camp. And I remembered programming galore dealing with the Holocaust, programming that involved discussion groups, that involved role plays, various kind of reenactments, as well as our ritual somewhat religious observance, particularly given the fact that in the summer there is an annual fast day, Tisha B'Av, which is associated with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 586 before the Common Era in 70 AD by the Babylonians and the Romans. And so this is the one Jewish holiday that occurs during the summer that Jewish summer camps always engaged with, and in the camp I went to, the that memorial service was always about the Holocaust. Okay, and then finally, I remembered that the prayer book for the High Holidays, which in the post-war period had 80-90% of American Jews going to High Holiday services. So the prayer book published by the conservative movement in 1951, I remembered it so distinctly for Yom Kippur. Again, the single day where most Jews attended synagogue, and people who never went any other time would come on that day. And there in the prayer book had been this reading called 2 Hours, 6 Million. And so I was interested in my book, also at looking at liturgy, liturgies that actually got printed into prayer books, liturgies that different individuals floated and suggested that didn't make it. But these provided three of the venues, that is summer camp work, public morning events, as well as the religious sector, provided three focuses to my scholarship. But I looked everywhere. I looked at music, at press releases from organizations, pedagogical work, film strips, material in the Jewish press, letters to the editor of general newspapers, flyers, brochures, posters, radio shows that were intended to get to inspire American Jews to give money to assist the survivors, the writings of young people in youth groups. And I would say I tried to see something from every segment of American Jewry because it was a very divided community in terms of ideology and in terms of the kind of thorny question of what does it mean to be a Jew in America in the modern world.
I'll say, did you also get a sense of what Jewish families in America were talking about when the subject came up, in the living room in on an evening?
Yes. Okay, so that, again, raises a very interesting question. I think it's nearly impossible for a historian to recover those kinds of details. And while many of the people I have spoken to about this, when I give a lecture in the question and answer period, people will say either my family talked about it all the time, or they'll say my parents never talked about it. And it's impossible to know. I think our memories are pretty faulty. I think the way all people at all, remember the past is terribly shaped by the contemporary world in which they live. And so I made a point in conceptualizing this book that I was not going to be looking at what happened in the family circle and was not what happened in the informal places, what kids might have talked about on the playground, because we have no paper trail to verify it. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody says to me my parents never talked about it, there's no way I as a historian can go back and corroborate that or not. But if somebody says, I went to a particular summer camp and we did or did not talk about it, that usually allows me, that institutional framework allows me to go into the archives and find something of the of a written record about what went on. And so in that case, I really steered away from what went on in the living room.
How did refugees who either left before the war got too dangerous for them to do so, or Holocaust survivors who eventually emigrated to the United States, how did they assimilate into existing Jewish communities?
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent question. One of the elements of the myth of silence is that when Holocaust survivors came to the United States, either they didn't want to talk, they were so traumatized by this, or they were told by larger community, by people who were involved in their resettlement, that they ought not talk because nobody was interested. Now, again, I can never reconstruct what survivors, like any other, you know, as I can't reconstruct what any other person or people may have said within their homes, but in the public sphere, survivors from very early date were active players in the construction of this memorial culture. And so survivors show up to communal events, large ones and small ones, talked about what had happened to them. The Jewish newspapers and most of the larger cities had a communal paper, the Chicago Jewish Sentinel, the Boston Jewish Advocate, the Wisconsin Jewish Chronicle, and so on. And these newspapers were full of stories about the survivors who had come to their who had come and settled in these towns, in these cities. Many of these newspapers carried interviews with survivors, in which the survivors told the reporter in extreme detail nature of what had happened to them. Survivors organized politically. They found organizations in many, many cities, which were both, they were social institutions and they were places, no doubt, very comfortable for people who had had a shared experience, a shared traumatic experience, but they also functioned as educational and as lobbying groups. And so, for example, there was a survivors group in New York, which in 1959 founded a summer camp for their own children called Camp Hemshech, which means continuity, and children from non-survivor families also came to this camp, and the programming of the camp was very much focused on the Holocaust. The same group, which published a newspaper, in the newspaper, one could track what their activities were, and a delegation of them went to Washington to meet with their senators and to lobby over issues that mattered to them. In a variety of other ways, they became, on the one hand, a coherent group of survivors, and on the other hand, they interacted with the larger American Jewish community and had an impact in as much as they told their story.
When you talk about the evolution of Holocaust memorial culture from its very earliest sort of inchoate forms to what we recognize today, you make the very important point that I think a lot of people may not think about when they're considering this, that there was no precedent at the time. There hadn't been an event like this. There weren't big museums. There weren't ethnic museums in this country at the time. So they were sort of starting from square one.
So they had, one could say on the one hand, they had no precedent in as much as even within Jewish culture, while there had certainly been many, many tragedies in the past, those tragedies had not for many centuries entered into the liturgy or really changed the basic shape of Jewish life. And so that in a way, the post-war American Jews were kind of going it on their own in terms of, for example, wanting to write a liturgy and have it in the prayer book, or to create a memorial day and have it observed as in religious terms. So that Jewish history itself didn't provide them with really good models. And some of the argumentation that went on within the Jewish community was over modern Jews, you know, Jews of the 20th century, have the right to create new rituals? And the most traditional said, no, we can't do that, even though we might want to. We can't. We don't have the authority, because it was only in the past that Jews could do that. And secondly, they had really no partners. There were no other ethnic communities in America which had organized, let's say, university courses to deal with their tragedies, or organized museums or large public monuments in prominent spaces in city center. So that they, American Jews were very much going it on their own, as they had to figure out, how do we approach the American public and try to make room for what happened, and what are the barriers to our getting them to listen? So in the early 1950s, when a number of Holocaust-related books, the most famous of which was Diary of Anne Frank, although it was not the only, when these books came out, local Jewish community councils in a number of cities bought up hundreds of copies of these books and placed them in public libraries and in elementary, junior high school, and high school libraries, because they assumed that the librarians and the officials of the public schools would not put these books in the libraries themselves. Their sense was that nobody... libraries wouldn't want these books, and so it therefore behooved them as Jews to get these books in, as Jewish community leaders, to get these books into the hands of Americans. By the late 1960s, in a number of cities, in fact, in each one of the cities that had this book buying project, they began to try to meet with public school officials about possibly teaching, devoting some time in the curriculum to talking about, they would often say, the tragedy of the Jews under the Nazis, or the crimes of the Third Reich. And interestingly, they failed in every case. And what the school officials told them was, well, if we made time in the curriculum for your tragedy, we'd have to open it up to everybody else's also. Okay, this is obviously, before public schools taught African American history, Native American history, and so on. And this is obviously such a stark contrast to the world we live in now, where a number of states have, for example, mandated Holocaust curriculum. And I know in New Jersey, they teach it in every grade. The Holocaust has to be taught. Florida has mandated Holocaust curriculum, New York, Illinois. So it was a very different world, and American Jews really didn't have any examples that they could follow and to say, well, this is how the Irish have done it, or this is how the Armenians have done it, or this is how African Americans have done it. In the post-war period, there was a tendency in American culture to try to universalize all issues, and so to then try to go public with a very unique and unprecedented experience was something that they had to kind of construct from the ground up, and there was no consensus as to what the best way to do that was.
Hasia Diner is my guest. We're talking about her new book, We Remember with Reverence and Love, American Jews and the Myth of Silence After the Holocaust, 1945 to 1962. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment, and we will read your emails to think@kera.org and take your calls at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Hasia Diner is my guest. She is director of the Goldstein-Gorin Center for American Jewish History at NYU. Her new book is called We Remember with Reverence and Love, American Jews and the Myth of Silence After the Holocaust, 1945 to 1962. You can email us at think@kera.org, and that is where we hear this statement from Stephen, who says, When I was growing up in Baltimore in the 1970s and 80s, we were routinely told by Holocaust survivors that American Jews had abandoned European Jews during World War II. However, whenever I ask a Jew who lived here in the United States during the 1940s, they all insist we didn't know what was happening to the Jews in Europe. We were in the dark. And I guess my follow-up question to that statement, Hasia, is did U.S. Jews feel any particular culpability for the failure of the United States as an entire country to have prevented the Holocaust?
Okay, I think that's a great question. So for one thing, the two sorts of memories that you, the memory you have of Holocaust survivors, or in a sense a kind of general narrative saying American Jews didn't know anything and didn't care, is another myth. It's not the one I wrote about, but in fact, American Jewish communal life in the from the 1930s and the 1940s was absolutely throbbing with questions about what to do about this, you know, the Jews of Europe, and a sense of a tremendous impotence that there was in fact nothing they could do. But having said that, in the I think one of the differences between the period I was looking at, that is the post-war 45 into the early 1960s versus the period you grew up in, the 1970s, is that in the period I looked at, nobody was saying we didn't do enough. What they said was what we did failed. Hmm. We tried, we did what we could, and we were unable to make any appreciable impact on the horrendous situation that developed in Europe. But they were not, we might say, beating up on themselves or beating up on the generation that had been in the running the Jewish communal organizations and institutions. And part of the narrative that I saw in the 1950s was a kind of celebration of how much American Jews had tried. And there's a very popular American Jewish history book that's written in 1954, and the chapter on the Holocaust era was called American Jews to the Rescue. And so they focused on the fact that, you know, several hundred thousand Jews did come to the United States, and that American Jewish organizations had been involved in, for example, finding refuge for Jews in places like the Dominican Republic and other parts of Central America. So while they surely regretted how little they had done, their emphasis was on, indeed, the tremendous effort. And I think that provides us with a difference between the post-war period versus, again, the years of the 1970s, where experiences were formed.
And again, those were an emailer from Stephen, but okay. Yeah, the question okay. Was mine. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Martin in Dallas. Hello, Martin.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I am a second-generation Holocaust survivor. First refugees to come from Europe to New Orleans. And growing up, it was hard for us to assimilate into the American society. First, we had to become Americans by becoming citizens. But my parents always wanted me to be part of the American culture and what went on. And I would like to meet you and talk further with you about the details of, you said, the paper trails of what was said, and I'm a living history of walking that. My father talks nationally, locally, on the Holocaust, and, you know, he made a promise to his mother. She was going off to the death camp. Boys, when you survive, tell the world what you saw, hear, and heard, and don't let anybody ever forget what we did, what happened to us. With that, growing up in the synagogues, we were second-class citizens. We didn't have the same forefront. People didn't ask us about our past. We hung together as second generation as well as refugees because, you know, they looked at us differently. But there were other organizations that helped out in bringing us together in a very progressive standpoint to be assimilated in the Jewish community centers, in the schools, and now being involved with the Holocaust Center in Dallas, as well as the one in Washington and the one in New Orleans on the riverfront, it's bringing more to the forefront of being chic being a second generation as well as a survivor. My father speaks at Tulane, talks on the telephone around the way. He's a Katrina survivor as well as a Holocaust survivor, but he has made that promise, and he's assimilating, and people are getting more and more interested in listening and understanding because they were in the dark about things. But I feel very proud as a Jew and as an American, and, you know, God bless America. That's what my father says. I do, too. And being part and telling the story of what we went through to survive, to keep the thread of life, of Judaism alive, of either going to Israel or coming back. And it would be a pleasure to speak more with you and, you know, discuss this. It is a great issue. It's very coming to the forefront more and more now with the deniers. You know, as the survivors are dying out at 2,000 to 2,500 a year, look at what the D-Day survivors are going. They're going away, too. And we are walking history of what life was in the past, and people want to have that warm, fuzzy feeling of hearing what happened and what our lives were like and how we have now become part of an American, you know, chic.
Martin, thanks so much for your call. Do you want to respond to that, Hasia?
Yes, I'll respond. And although there was no question, and I think there are a couple things I'd like to say. First is that while, again, I can't speak about any one person's experience, what is notable in the records of the various, you know, Jewish communities, the degree to which the survivors were being reached out to, if sometimes just symbolically, sometimes more than that, take a place within the community. And so, for example, at many of these Warsaw Ghetto Memorial programs, which I kind of began with my personal recollections of, it was always the case that there would they in the programs of the sort of these in the program notes or in the brochures that describe the proceedings, they would say the lighting of the six candles. These were all six symbolic candles, one for each million, and it would say being lit by a new American, meaning a survivor. That was one of the euphemisms, or the personal testimony. So a survivor would get up and tell about their experience. Not necessarily in Warsaw, but their experience during the Holocaust. Similarly, there were points in time when the survivors had a very different idea of how the community should function, and interestingly, were listened to. And so, I'm going to give one example. In early 1960, George Lincoln Rockwell, the Führer of the American Nazi Party, kind of flashed onto the American scene, and he wore a stormtrooper uniform with a swastika, and he had his group of followers, and they came to New York, Boston, Washington, a number of other cities, and Jewish community leaders had long operated under the what was called the quarantine philosophy, which was when some kind of demagogue, anti-Semitic demagogue, gets up and holds a rally, the best strategy was to ignore them, because what the demagogue wanted was to get headlines in the newspaper. And if nobody shows up to heckle or nobody shows up with a counter protest, there'll be no news coverage. When George Lincoln Rockwell came on the scene, the survivors in, again, Boston and New York and Washington and Chicago all said, no, we don't accept this quarantine philosophy. For those of us, you know, who have numbers tattooed on our arms, those of us who were in the concentration camps, quarantine doesn't work. And interestingly, the community institutions and the Jewish community newspapers, and sometimes there were radio shows sponsored by these Jewish community councils, all paid very close attention to what the survivors were saying, and they backtracked, you know, from their quarantine philosophy. And now it may be the kind of thing that a child in a survivor family might not necessarily know this was going on, but it was a real impact that the survivors had on communal strategy. And they were very forthright talking about what had happened to them, and the communal leaders who were not survivors responded accordingly. The caller had also talked about deniers. Now, importantly, denying the Holocaust begins in the late 1940s. It's not just in our times. And one of the key reasons why Holocaust memorialization takes off in the late 1940s was in the face of these deniers. Many of them were in France, a number in the United States, often associated with, again, far right-wing anti-Semitic groups. And the memorialization process was very much the memorialization process, and the process also of trying to keep the story of the Holocaust in the public eye was very much intended to combat the deniers.
Hasia, why is it so important to ensure that we get this part of the history right?
Well, as a historian, I believe we should get history right in general, no
Granted.
Matter what the topic.
Yeah.
So I think it's very important, you know, that people be open to recognizing that the past, as we have been conventionally taught, when subjected to empirical research, is going to look very different. But I think this colors contemporary debates about Israel. I think within the American Jewish world, there is still much to be gained by those people who want to say that that the post-war generation denied the Holocaust, because it then elevates the generation that came of age in the late 1960s, and it makes the people who, again, come of age in the late 1960s, and who, in essence, are so many of the scholars and community leaders now, it allows them to take credit for something they didn't do.
Are you finding that the next generation of scholars, the ones who came of age in the late 80s and early 90s, are more open to this idea than their predecessors?
I think that younger scholars are much more open, because they don't have they didn't come out of that late 60s ferment, and therefore they don't have a stake in the repetition of the story. But notably, until my book came out, everybody has agreed with the prevailing narrative about the silence of the post-war era. And I find that when I give talks to scholarly groups and to groups also more popular audiences, it is the younger people who say, you know what, I'd never learned that. That's really interesting. While people who grew up in the post-war period tend to really dig their heels in and say, wait a minute, that's wrong. It never happened. And even when I have at various talks handed out Xeroxes or photocopies of articles from Jewish newspapers that show how this got written up in the Jewish press, and the people in the audience might be actually holding the documents in their hand, they'll still say, no, it didn't happen that way, because it contradicts their very firm belief that they know the history.
Hmm. Do you think it's a function of having a dog in the fight, or perceiving that one has a dog in the fight?
To a certain degree, I think. I think that in general, people like to think they know what happened, and particularly if it happened in their own, around them, in their growing up. I think they like to believe that they really remember, and it's kind of disorienting if somebody says to you, you know, you actually aren't remembering it the way it was. And I've had people who say, well, again, I belong to a certain organization, and we never talked about it. And I have been through the newsletters of that organization, and I say, you know, actually, it was talked about in every single issue.
Hasia Diner is the author of a new book called We Remember with Reverence and Love, American Jews and the Myth of Silence After the Holocaust, 1945 to 1962. Hasia, it's been so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.